Listening Library presents Little Brother by Cory Doctorow. Read for you by Kirby Hayborn. Chapter 1. I'm a senior at Cesar Chavez High in San Francisco's sunny Mission District, and that makes me one of the most surveilled people in the world. My name is Marcus Yallow, but back when this story starts, I was going by W1N5T0N, pronounced Winston. Not pronounced W1N5T0N, unless you're a clueless disciplinary officer who's far enough behind the curve that you still call the Internet the Information Superhighway. I know just such a clueless person, and his name is Fred Benson, one of three vice principals at Cesar Chavez. He's a sucking chest wound of a human being, but if you're going to have a jailer, better a clueless one than one who's really on the ball.
Marcus Yallow,
he said over the PA one Friday morning. The PA isn't very good to begin with, and when you combine that with Benson's habitual mumble, you get something that sounds more like someone struggling to digest a bad burrito than a school announcement. But human beings are good at picking their names out of audio confusion. It's a survival trait. I grabbed my bag and folded my laptop three-quarters shut, I didn't want to blow my downloads, and got ready for the inevitable.
Report to the administration office immediately.
My social studies teacher, Mrs. Galvez, rolled her eyes at me, and I rolled my eyes back at her. The man was always coming down on me. Just because I go through school firewalls like wet Kleenex, spoof the gate recognition software, and nuke the snitch chips they track us with. Galvez is a good type, anyway. Never holds that against me. Especially when I'm helping get with her webmail so she can talk to her brother who's stationed in Iraq. My boy Daryl gave me a smack on the ass as I walked past. I've known Daryl since we were still in diapers and escaping from play school, and I've been getting him into and out of trouble the whole time. I raised my arms over my head like a prize fighter and made my exit from social studies and began the perp walk to the office. I was halfway there when my phone went. That was another no-no. Phones are muy prohibido at Chavez High. But why should that stop me? I ducked into the toilet and shut myself in the middle stall. The farthest stall is always grossest, because so many people head straight for it, hoping to escape the smell and the squick. The smart money and good hygiene is down the middle. I checked the phone. My home PC had sent it an email to tell it that there was something new up on Harajuku Fun Madness, which happens to be the best game ever invented. I grinned. Spending Fridays at school was to suck anyway, and I was glad of the excuse to make my escape. I ambled the rest of the way to Benson's office and tossed him a wave as I sailed through the door.
"If it isn't W1N5T0N, he said.
Frederick Benson. Social Security number 545-03-2343. Date of birth, August 15, 1962. Mother's maiden name, Debona. Hometown, Petaluma, is a lot taller than me. I'm a runty 5'8", while he stands 6'7", and his college basketball days are far enough behind him that his chest muscles have turned into saggy man boobs that were painfully obvious through his freebie.com polo shirts. He always looks like he's about to slam dunk your ass, and he's really into raising his voice for dramatic effect. Both these start to lose their efficacy with repeated application. "Sorry. Nope," I said. "I never heard of this R2-D2 character of yours."
W1N5T0N, he said, spelling it out again.
He gave me a hairy eyeball and waited for me to wilt. Of course it was my handle, and had been for years. It was the identity I used when I was posting on message boards where I was making my contributions to the field of applied security research. You know, like sneaking out of school and disabling the minder tracer on my phone. But he didn't know that this was my handle. Only a small number of people did, and I trusted them all to the end of the earth. Not ringing any bells, I said. I'd done some pretty cool stuff around school using that handle. I was very proud of my work on snitch tag killers, and if he could link the two identities, I'd be in trouble. No one at school ever called me W1N5T0N or even Winston, not even my pals. It was Marcus or nothing. Benson settled down behind his desk and tapped his class ring nervously on his blotter. He did this whenever things started to go bad for him. Poker players call stuff like this a tell, something that lets you know what's going on in the other guy's head. I knew Benson's tells backwards and forwards. Marcus, I hope you realize how serious this is. I will just as soon as you explain what this is, sir. I always say sir to authority figures when I'm messing with them. It's my own tell. He shook his head at me and looked down. Another tell. Any second now, he was going to start shouting at me. Listen, kiddo. It's time you came to grips with the fact that we know about what you've been doing and that we're not going to be lenient about it. You're going to be lucky if you're not expelled before this meeting is through. Do you want to graduate? Mr. Benson, you still haven't explained what the problem is. He slammed his hand down on the desk and then pointed his finger at me. The problem, Mr. Yallow, is that you've been engaged in criminal conspiracy to subvert this school's security system, and you have supplied security countermeasures to your fellow students. You know that we expelled Graciela Uriarte last week for using one of your devices. Uriarte had gotten a bad rap. She'd bought a radio jammer from a head shop near the 16th Street BART station, and it had set off the countermeasures in the school hallway. Not my doing, but I felt for her. And you think I'm involved in that? We have reliable intelligence indicating that you are W1N5T0N. Again, he spelled it out. And I began to wonder if he hadn't figured out that the 1 was an I and the 5 was an S. We know that this W1N5T0N character is responsible for the theft of last year's standardized tests. That actually hadn't been me, but it was a sweet hack, and it was kind of flattering to hear it attributed to me. And therefore liable for several years in prison unless you cooperate with me. You have reliable intelligence? I'd like to see it. He glowered at me. Your attitude isn't going to help you. If there's evidence, sir, I think you should call the police and turn it over to them. It sounds like this is a very serious matter, and I wouldn't want to stand in the way of a proper investigation by the duly constituted authorities. You want me to call the police. And my parents, I think. That would be for the best. We stared at each other across the desk. He'd clearly expected me to fold the second he dropped the bomb on me. I don't fold. I have a trick for staring down people like Benson. I look slightly to the left of their heads and think about the lyrics to old Irish folk songs, the kind with 300 verses. It makes me look perfectly composed and unworried. And the wing was on the bird, and the bird was on the egg, and the egg was in the nest, and the nest was on the leaf. And the leaf was on the twig, and the twig was on the branch, and the branch was on the limb, and the limb was in the tree, and the tree was in the bog down in the valley-o. Hi-ho, the rattlin' bog, the bog down in the valley-o. You can return to class now, he said. I'll call on you once the police are ready to speak to you. Are you going to call them now? The procedure for calling in the police is complicated. I had hoped that we could settle this fairly and quickly, but since you insist... I can wait while you call them is all, I said. I don't mind. He tapped his ring again, and I braced for the blast. Go! He yelled. Get the hell out of my office, you miserable little... I got out, keeping my expression neutral. He wasn't going to call the cops. If he'd had enough evidence to go to the police with... he would have called them in the first place. He hated my guts. I figured he'd heard some unverified gossip and hoped to spook me into confirming it. I moved down the corridor, lightly and sprightly, keeping my gait even and measured for the gate recognition cameras. These had been installed only a year before, and I loved them for their sheer idiocy. Beforehand, we'd had face recognition cameras covering nearly every public space in school, but a court ruled that was unconstitutional. So Benson and a lot of other paranoid school administrators had spent our textbook dollars on these idiot cameras that were supposed to be able to tell one person's walk from another. Yeah, right. I got back to class and sat down again, Ms. Galvez warmly welcoming me back. I unpacked the school's standard-issue machine and got back into classroom mode. The school books were the snitchiest technology of them all. Logging every keystroke, watching all the network traffic for suspicious keywords, counting every click, keeping track of every fleeting thought you put out over the net. We'd gotten them in my junior year, and it only took a couple months for the shininess to wear off. Once people figured out that these free laptops worked for the man and showed a never-ending parade of obnoxious ads to boot, they suddenly started to feel very heavy and burdensome. Cracking my schoolbook had been easy. The crack was online within a month of the machine showing up, and there was nothing to it. Just download a DVD image, burn it, stick it in the schoolbook, and boot it while holding down a bunch of different keys at the same time. The DVD did the rest, installing a whole bunch of hidden programs on the machine, programs that would stay hidden even when the Board of Ed did its daily remote integrity checks of the machines. Every now and again I had to get an update for the software to get around the board's latest tests, but it was a small price to pay to get a little control over the box. I fired up I Am Paranoid, the secret instant messenger that I used when I wanted to have an off-the-record discussion, right in the middle of class. Daryl was already logged in. "The game's afoot. Something big is going down with Harajuku Fun Madness, dude. You in?" "No freaking way. If I get caught ditching a third time, I'm expelled. Man, you know that. We'll go after school. You've got lunch and then study hall, right? That's 2 hours. Plenty of time to run down this clue and get back before anyone misses us. I'll get the whole team out." Harajuku Fun Madness is the best game ever made. I know I already said that, but it bears repeating. It's an ARG, an alternate reality game, and the story goes that a gang of Japanese fashion teens discovered a miraculous healing gem at the temple in Harajuku, which is basically where cool Japanese teenagers invented every major subculture for the past 10 years. They're being hunted by evil monks, the Yakuza, a.k.a. the Japanese Mafia, aliens, tax inspectors, parents, and a rogue artificial intelligence. They slip the players coded messages that we have to decode and use to track down clues that lead to more coded messages and more clues. Imagine the best afternoon you've ever spent prowling the streets of a city, checking out all the weird people, funny handbills, street maniacs, and funky shops. Now add a scavenger hunt to that, one that requires you to research crazy old films and songs and teen culture from around the world and across time and space. And it's a competition, with the winning team of four taking a grand prize of 10 days in Tokyo, chilling on Harajuku Bridge, geeking out in Akihabara, and taking home all the Astro Boy merchandise you can eat. Except that he's called Adam Boy in Japan. That's Harajuku Fun Madness. And once you've solved a puzzle or two, you'll never look back. No, man, just no. No. Don't even ask. I need you, D. You're the best I've got. I swear I'll get us in and out without anyone knowing it. You know I can do that, right? I know you can do it. So you're in? Hell no. Come on, Daryl. You're not going to your deathbed wishing you'd spent more study periods sitting in school. I'm not going to my deathbed wishing I'd spent more time playing ARGs either. Yeah, but don't you think you might go to your deathbed wishing you'd spent more time with Vanessa Pock? Van was part of my team. She went to a private girls' school in the East Bay, but I knew she'd ditch to come out and run the mission with me. Daryl has had a crush on her, literally, for years, even before puberty endowed her with many lavish gifts. Daryl had fallen in love with her mind. Sad, really. You suck. You're coming? He looked at me and shook his head. Then he nodded. I winked at him and set to work getting in touch with the rest of my team. I wasn't always into arguing. I have a dark secret. I used to be a LARPer. LARPing is live-action role-playing, and it's just about what it sounds like. Running around in costume, talking in a funny accent, pretending to be a super spy or a vampire or a medieval knight. It's like Capture the Flag in Monster Drag, with a bit of drama club thrown in, and the best games were the ones we played in scout camps out of town in Sonoma or down on the peninsula. Those three-day epics could get pretty hairy, with all-day hikes, epic battles with foam and bamboo swords, casting spells by throwing beanbags and shouting, "Fireball!" and so on. Good fun, if a little goofy. Not nearly as geeky as talking about what your elf planned on doing as you sat around a table loaded with Diet Coke cans and painted miniatures, and more physically active than going into a mouse coma in front of a massively multiplayer game at home. The thing that got me into trouble were the mini-games in the hotels. Whenever a science fiction convention came to town, some LARPer would convince them to let us run a couple of 6-hour mini-games at the con, piggybacking on their rental of the space. Having a bunch of enthusiastic kids running around in costume lent color to the event, and we got to have a ball among people even more socially deviant than us. The problem with hotels is that they have a lot of non-gamers in them, too. They're not just sci-fi people. Normal people. From states that begin and end with vowels. On holidays. And sometimes those people misunderstand the nature of a game. Let's just leave it at that, okay? Class ended in 10 minutes, and that didn't leave me with much time to prepare. The first order of business was those pesky gate recognition cameras. Like I said, they'd started out as face recognition cameras, but those had been ruled unconstitutional. As far as I know, no court has yet determined whether these gate cams are any more legal, but until they do, we're stuck with them. Gate is a fancy word for the way you walk. People are pretty good at spotting gates. Next time you're on a camping trip, check out the bobbing of the flashlight as a distant friend approaches you. Chances are you can identify him just from the movement of the light, the characteristic way it bobs up and down that tells our monkey brains that this is a person approaching us. Gate recognition software takes pictures of your motion, tries to isolate you in the pics as a silhouette, and then tries to match the silhouette to a database to see if it knows who you are. It's a biometric identifier like fingerprints or retina scans, but it's got a lot more collisions than either of those. A biometric collision is when a measurement matches more than one person. Only you have your fingerprint, but you share your gait with plenty other people. Not exactly, of course. Your personal inch-by-inch walk is yours and yours alone. The problem is your inch-by-inch walk changes based on how tired you are, what the floor is made of, whether you pulled your ankle playing basketball, and whether you've changed your shoes lately. So the system kind of fuzzes out your profile, looking for people who walk kind of like you. There are a lot of people who walk kind of like you. What's more, it's easy not to walk kind of like you. Just take one shoe off. Of course, you'll always walk like you with one shoe off in that case, so the cameras will eventually figure out that it's still you, which is why I prefer to inject a little randomness into my attacks on gait recognition. I put a handful of gravel into each shoe. Cheap and effective, and no two steps are the same. Plus, you get a great reflexology foot massage in the process. I kid. Reflexology is about as scientifically useful as gait recognition. The cameras used to set off an alert every time someone they didn't recognize stepped onto campus. This did not work. The alarm went off every 10 minutes, when the mailman came by, when a parent dropped in, when the groundspeople went to work fixing up the basketball court, when a student showed up wearing new shoes. So now it just tries to keep track of who's where, when. If someone leaves by the school gates during classes, their gait is checked to see if it kinda sorta matches any student gait, and if it does, whoop, 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 ring the alarm! Chavez High is ringed with gravel walkways. I like to keep a couple hands full of rocks in my shoulder bag, just in case. I silently pass Daryl 10 or 15 pointy little bastards, and we both loaded our shoes. Class was about to finish up, and I realized that I still hadn't checked the Harajuku Fun Madness site to see where the next clue was. I'd been a little hyper-focused on the escape and hadn't bothered to figure out where we were escaping to. I turned to my school book and hit the keyboard. The web browser we used was supplied with a machine. It was a locked-down spyware version of Internet Explorer, Microsoft's crashware turd that no one under the age of 40 used voluntarily. I had a copy of Firefox on the USB drive built into my watch, but that wasn't enough. The schoolbook ran Windows Vista for Schools, an antique operating system designed to give school administrators the illusion that they controlled the programs their students could run. But Vista for Schools is its own worst enemy. There are a lot of programs that Vista for Schools doesn't want you to be able to shut down. Keyloggers, sensorware, and these programs run in a special mode that makes them invisible to the system. You can't quit them because you can't even see they're there. Any program whose name starts with $SYS$ is invisible to the operating system. It doesn't show up on listings of the hard drive, nor in the process monitor. So my copy of Firefox was called $SYS$Firefox. And as I launched it, it became invisible to Windows, and thus invisible to the network's snoopware. Now that I had an indie browser running, I needed an indie network connection. The school's network logged every click in and out of the system, which was bad news if you were planning on surfing over to the Harajuku Fun Madness site for some extracurricular fun. The answer is something ingenious called Tor, the Onion Router. An Onion Router is an internet site that takes requests for web pages and passes them on to other Onion Routers, and on to other Onion Routers, until one of them finally decides to fetch the page and pass it back through the layers of the Onion until it reaches you. The traffic to the Onion Routers is encrypted, which means that the school can't see what you're asking for, and the layers of the Onion don't know who they're working for. There are millions of nodes. The program was set up by the U.S. Office of Naval Research to help their people get around the censorware in countries like Syria and China, which means that it's perfectly designed for operating in the confines of an average American high school. Tor works because the school has a finite blacklist of naughty addresses we aren't allowed to visit, and the addresses of the nodes change all the time. No way could the school keep track of them all. Firefox and Tor together made me into the invisible man, impervious to Board of Ed snooping, free to check out the Harajuku FM site and see what was up. There it was, a new clue. Like all Harajuku Fun Madness clues, it had a physical, online, and mental component. The online component was a puzzle you had to solve, one that required you to research the answers to a bunch of obscure questions. This batch included a bunch of questions on the plots in doujinshi. Those are comic books drawn by fans of manga, Japanese comics. They can be as big as the official comics that inspire them, but they're a lot weirder, with crossover storylines and sometimes really silly songs and action. Lots of love stories, of course. Everyone loves to see their favorite tunes hook up. I'd have to solve those riddles later, when I got home. They were easiest to solve with the whole team. downloading tons of doujinshi files and scouring them for answers to the puzzles. I'd just finished scrapbooking all the clues when the bell rang, and we began our escape. I surreptitiously slid the gravel down the side of my short boots, ankle-high blundstones from Australia, great for running and climbing, and the easy slip-on, slip-off laceless design makes them convenient at the never-ending metal detectors that are everywhere now. We also had to evade physical surveillance, of course, but that gets easier every time they add a new layer of physical snoopery. All the bells and whistles lull our beloved faculty into a totally false sense of security. We surfed the crowd down the hallways, heading for my favorite side exit. We were halfway along when Daryl hissed, "Crap! I forgot! I've got a library book in my bag!" "You're kidding me," I said, and hauled him into the next bathroom we passed. Library books are bad news. Every one of them has an ARFID, radio frequency ID tag, glued into its binding, which makes it possible for the librarians to check out the books by waving them over a reader, and lets a library shelf tell you if any of the books on it are out of place. But it also lets the school track where you are at all times. It was another of those legal loopholes. The courts wouldn't let the schools track us with ARFIDs, but they could track library books and use the school records to tell them who was likely to be carrying which library book. I had a little Faraday pouch in my bag. These are little wallets lined with a mesh of copper wires that effectively block radio energy, silencing ARFIDs. But the pouches were made for neutralizing ID cards and toll book transponders, not books like Introduction to Physics, I groaned. The book was the size of a dictionary. Chapter 2. "I'm thinking of majoring in physics when I go to Berkeley," Daryl said. His dad taught at the University of California at Berkeley, which meant he'd get free tuition when he went. And there'd never been any question in Daryl's household about whether he'd go. "Fine, but couldn't you research it online?" "My dad said I should read it. Besides, I didn't plan on committing any crimes today." "Skipping school isn't a crime. It's an infraction. They're totally different." "What are we going to do, Marcus?"
"Well, I can't hide it, so I'm going to have to nuke it."
Killing ARFIDs is a dark art. No merchant wants malicious customers going for a walk around the shop floor and leaving behind a bunch of lobotomized merchandise that is missing its invisible barcode, so the manufacturers have refused to implement a kill signal that you can radio to an ARFID to get it to switch off. You can reprogram ARFIDs with the right box, but I hate doing that to library books. It's not exactly tearing pages out of a book, but it's still bad, since a book with a reprogrammed ARFID can't be shelved and can't be found. It just becomes a needle in a haystack. That left me with only one option: nuking the thing. Literally. 30 seconds in a microwave will do in pretty much every ARFID on the market. And because the ARFID wouldn't answer at all when Dee checked it back in at the library, they'd just print a fresh one for it and recode it with the book's catalog info, and it would end up clean and neat back on its shelf. All we needed was a microwave. "Give it another 2 minutes and the teacher's lounge will be empty," I said. Daryl grabbed his book and headed for the door.
"Forget it. No way. I'm going to class."
I snagged his elbow and dragged him back.
"Come on, Dee. Easy now. It'll be fine."
"The teacher's lounge? Maybe you weren't listening, Marcus. If I get busted just once more, I am expelled. You hear that? Expelled."
"You won't get caught," I said.
The one place a teacher wouldn't be after this period was the lounge.
"We'll go in the back way."
The lounge had a little kitchenette off to one side, with its own entrance for teachers who just wanted to pop in and get a cup of joe. The microwave, which always reeked of popcorn and spilled soup, was right in there, on top of the miniature fridge. Daryl groaned. I thought fast.
"Look, the bell's already rung. If you go to study hall now, you'll get a late slip. Better not to show at all at this point. I can infiltrate and exfiltrate any room on this campus, Dee. You've seen me do it. I'll keep you safe, bro.
He groaned again. That was one of Daryl's tells. Once he starts groaning, he's ready to give in.
Let's roll,
I said, and we took off. It was flawless. We skirted the classrooms, took the back stairs into the basement, and came up the front stairs right in front of the teacher's lounge. Not a sound came from the door, and I quietly turned the knob and dragged Daryl in before silently closing the door. The book just barely fit in the microwave, which was looking even less sanitary than it had the last time I'd popped in here to use it. I conscientiously wrapped it in paper towels before I set it down.
Man, teachers are pigs, I hissed.
Daryl, white-faced and tense, said nothing. The ARFID died in a shower of sparks, which was really quite lovely, though not nearly as pretty as the effect you get when you nuke a frozen grape, which has to be seen to be believed. Now, to exfiltrate the campus in perfect anonymity and make our escape. Daryl opened the door and began to move out, me on his heels. A second later, he was standing on my toes, elbows jammed into my chest, as he tried to backpedal into the closet-sized kitchen we'd just left.
Get back, he whispered urgently. Quick, it's Charles.
Charles Walker and I don't get along. We're in the same grade and we've known each other as long as I've known Daryl, but that's where the resemblance ends. Charles has always been big for his age, and now that he's playing football and on the juice, he's even bigger. He's got anger management problems. I lost a milk tooth to him in the third grade, and he's managed to keep from getting in trouble over them by becoming the most active snitch in school. It's a bad combination, a bully who also snitches, taking great pleasure in going to the teachers with whatever infractions he's found. Benson loved Charles. Charles liked to let on that he had some kind of unspecified bladder problem, which gave him a ready-made excuse to prowl the hallways at Chavez, looking for people to think on. The last time Charles had caught some dirt on me, it had ended with me giving up LARPing. I had no intention of being caught by him again.
What's he doing? He's coming this way, is what he's doing,
Daryl said. He was shaking.
Okay,
I said.
Okay, time for emergency countermeasures.
I got my phone out. I'd planned this well in advance. Charles would never get me again. I emailed my server at home, and it got into motion. A few seconds later, Charles's phone spazzed out spectacularly. I'd had tens of thousands of simultaneous random calls and text messages sent to it, causing every chirp and ring it had to go off and keep going off. The attack was accomplished by means of a botnet, and for that I felt bad, but it was in the service of a good cause. Botnets are where infected computers spend their afterlives. When you get a worm or a virus, your computer sends a message to a chat channel on IRC, the Internet Relay Chat. That message tells the botmaster, the guy who deployed the worm, that the computer in there is ready to do his bidding. Botnets are supremely powerful, since they can comprise thousands, even hundreds of thousands of computers, scattered all over the Internet, connected to juicy high-speed connections and running on fast home PCs. Those PCs normally function on behalf of their owners, but when the botmaster calls them, they rise like zombies to do his bidding. There are so many infected PCs on the Internet that the price of hiring an hour or two on a botnet has crashed. Mostly these things work for spammers as cheap, distributed spam bots, filling your mailbox with come-ons for boner pills, or with new viruses that can infect you and recruit your machine to join the botnet. I just rented 10 seconds' time on 3,000 PCs and had each of them send a text message or voice-over IP call to Charles's phone, whose number I'd extracted from a sticky note on Benson's desk during one fateful office visit. Needless to say, Charles's phone was not equipped to handle this. First, the SMSs filled the memory on his phone, causing it to start choking on the routine operations it needed to do things like manage the ringer
and log all those incoming calls' bogus return numbers. Did you know that it's really easy to fake the return number on a caller ID? There are about 50 ways of doing it. Just Google spoof caller ID. Charles stared at it dumbfounded and jabbed at it furiously, his thick eyebrows nodding and wiggling as he struggled with the demons that had possessed his most personal of devices. The plan was working so far, but he wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing next. He was supposed to go find some place to sit down and try to figure out how to get his phone back. Daryl shook me by the shoulder, and I pulled my eye away from the crack in the door.
"What's he doing?" Daryl whispered.
"I totaled his phone, but he's just staring at it now instead of moving on." It wasn't going to be easy to reboot that thing. Once the memory was totally filled, it would have a hard time loading the code it needed to delete the bogus messages, and there was no bulk erase for text on his phone, so he'd have to manually delete all of the thousands of messages. Daryl shoved me back and stuck his eye up to the door. A moment later, his shoulders started to shake. I got scared, thinking he was panicking, but when he pulled back, I saw that he was laughing so hard that tears were streaming down his cheeks. Galvez just totally busted him for being in the halls during class and for having his phone out. You should have seen her tear into him. She was really enjoying it. We shook hands solemnly and snuck back out of the corridor, down the stairs, around the back, out the door, past the fence, and out into the glorious sunlight of afternoon in the mission. Valencia Street had never looked so good. I checked my watch and yelped. "Let's move! The rest of the gang is meeting us at the cable cars in 20 minutes.
Van spotted us first. She was blending in with a group of Korean tourists, which is one of her favorite ways of camouflaging herself when she's ditching school. Ever since the truancy moblog went live, our world is full of nosy shopkeepers and pecksniffs who take it upon themselves to snap our pickies and put them on the net where they can be perused by school administrators. She came out of the crowd and bounded toward us. Daryl has had a thing for Van since forever, and she's sweet enough to pretend she doesn't know it. She gave me a hug and then moved on to Daryl, giving him a quick sisterly kiss on the cheek that made him go red to the tops of his ears. The two of them made a funny pair. Daryl is a little on the heavy side, though he wears it well, and he's got a kind of pink complexion that goes red in the cheeks whenever he runs or gets excited. He's been able to grow a beard since we were 14, but thankfully he started shaving after a brief period known to our gang as the Lincoln years. And he's tall. Very, very tall. Like basketball player tall. Meanwhile, Van is half a head shorter than me, and skinny, with straight black hair that she wears in crazy elaborate braids that she researches on the net. She's got pretty coppery skin and dark eyes, and she loves big glass rings the size of radishes, which click and clack together when she dances. "Where's Holu?" she said. "How are you, Van?" Daryl asked in a choked voice. He always ran a step behind the conversation when it came to Van.
"I'm great, Dee. How's your every little thing?"
Oh, she was a bad, bad person. Daryl nearly fainted. Holu saved him from social disgrace by showing up just then in an oversized leather baseball jacket, sharp sneakers, and a mesh-back cap advertising our favorite Mexican-masked wrestler, El Santo Jr. Holu is Jose Luis Torres, the completing member of our foursome. He went to a super strict Catholic school in the outer Richmond, so it wasn't easy for him to get out. But he always did. No one exfiltrated like our Holu. He liked his jacket because it hung down low, which was pretty stylish in parts of the city, and covered up all his Catholic school crap, which was like a bullseye for nosy jerks with the truancy moblog bookmarked on their phones. "Who's ready to go?" I asked once we'd all said hello. I pulled out my phone and showed them the map I'd downloaded to it on the BART. "Near as I can work out, we want to go up to the Nico again, then one block past it to O'Farrell, then left up toward Van Ness. Somewhere in there we should find the wireless signal. Van made a face. That's a nasty part of the Tenderloin. I couldn't argue with her. That part of San Francisco is one of the weird bits. You go in through the Hilton's front entrance, and it's all touristy stuff like the cable car turnaround and family restaurants. Go through to the other side, and you're in the Loin, where every tracked-out transvestite hooker, hard-case pimp, hissing drug dealer, and cracked-up homeless person in town was concentrated. What they bought and sold, none of us were old enough to be a part of, though there were plenty of hookers our age plying their trade in the Loin. Look on the bright side, I said. The only time you want to go up around there is broad daylight. None of the other players are going to go near it until tomorrow, at the earliest. This is what we in the ARG business call a monster head start. Holu grinned at me. You make it sound like a good thing, he said. Beats eating uni, I said. We going to talk or we going to win, Van said. After me, she was hands down the most hardcore player in our group. She took winning very, very seriously. We struck out, four good friends, on our way to decode a clue, win the game, and lose everything we cared about forever. The physical component of today's clue was a set of GPS coordinates. There were coordinates for all the major cities where Harajuku Fun Madness was played, where we'd find a Wi-Fi access point signal. That signal was being deliberately jammed by another nearby Wi-Fi point that was hidden so that it couldn't be spotted by conventional Wi-Finders, little key fobs that told you when you were within range of someone's open access point, which you could use for free. We'd have to track down the location of the hidden access point by measuring the strength of the visible one, finding the spot where it was most mysteriously weakest. There, we'd find another clue. Last time it had been in the special of the day at Anzu, the swanky sushi restaurant in the Nikko Hotel in the Tenderloin. The Nikko was owned by Japan Airlines, one of Harajuku Fun Madness's sponsors, and the staff had all made a big fuss over us when we finally tracked down the clue. They'd given us bowls of miso soup and made us try uni, which is sushi made from sea urchin, with a texture of very runny cheese and a smell like very runny dog droppings. But it tasted really good, or so Daryl told me. I wasn't going to eat that stuff. I picked up the Wi-Fi signal with my phone's Wi-Finder about three blocks up O'Farrell, just before Hyde Street, in front of a dodgy Asian massage parlor, with a red blinking closed sign in the window. The network's name was Harajuku FM, so we knew we had the right spot. If it's in there, I'm not going, Daryl said. You all got your Wi-Finders? I said. Daryl and Van had phones with built-in Wi-Finders, while Holu, being too cool to carry a phone bigger than his pinky finger, had a separate little directional fob. Okay, fan out and see what we see. You're looking for a sharp drop-off in the signal that gets worse the more you move along it. I took a step backwards and ended up standing on someone's toes. A female voice said, "Oof," and I spun around, worried that some crackhoe was going to stab me for breaking her heels. Instead, I found myself face-to-face with another kid my age. She had a shock of bright pink hair and a sharp, rodent-like face, with big sunglasses that were practically Air Force goggles. She was dressed in striped tights beneath a black granny dress, with lots of little Japanese decor toys safety pinned to it, anime characters, old world leaders, emblems from foreign soda pop. She held up a camera and snapped a picture of me and my crew. "Cheese," she said. "You're on Candid Snitch Cam." "No way," I said. "You wouldn't." "I will," she said. "I will send this photo to Truant Watch in 30 seconds, unless you four back off from this clue and let me and my friends here run it down. You can come back in 1 hour and it'll be all yours. I think that's more than fair." I looked behind her and noticed three other girls in similar garb, one with blue hair, one with green, and one with purple. Who are you supposed to be? The Popsicle Squad?
We're the team that's going to kick your team's ass at Harajuku Fun Madness, she said. And I'm the one who's right this second about to upload your photo and get you in so much trouble.
Behind me, I felt Van start forward. Her all-girls school was notorious for its brawls, and I was pretty sure she was ready to knock this chick's block off. Then the world changed forever. We felt it first. That sickening lurch of the cement under your feet that every Californian knows instinctively. Earthquake. My first inclination, as always, was to get away. When in trouble or in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout. But the fact was, we were already in the safest place we could be. Not in a building that could fall in on us. Not out toward the middle of the road where bits of falling mortise could brain us. Earthquakes are eerily quiet. At first, anyway. But this wasn't quiet. This was loud. An incredible roaring sound that was louder than anything I'd ever heard before. The sound was so punishing it drove me to my knees, and I wasn't the only one. Daryl shook my arm and pointed over the buildings, and we saw it then. A huge black cloud rising from the northeast from the direction of the bay. There was another rumble, and the cloud of smoke spread out, that spreading black shape we'd all grown up seeing in movies. Someone had just blown up something, in a big way. There were more rumbles and more tremors. Heads appeared at windows up and down the street. We all looked at the mushroom cloud in silence. Then the sirens started. I'd heard sirens like these before. They test the civil defense sirens at noon on Tuesdays, but I'd only heard them go off unscheduled in old war movies and video games, the kind where someone is bombing someone else from above. Air raid sirens. The woo sound made it all less real. Report to shelters immediately. It was like the voice of God coming from all places at once. There were speakers on some of the electric poles, something I'd never noticed before, and they'd all switched on at once. Report to shelters immediately. Shelters? We looked at each other in confusion. What shelters? The cloud was rising steadily, spreading out. Was it nuclear? Were we breathing our last breaths? The girl with the pink hair grabbed her friends and they tore ass downhill, back toward the BART station and the foot of the hills. Report to shelters immediately. There was screaming now, and a lot of running around. Tourists, you can always spot the tourists. They're the ones who think California warm and spend their San Francisco holidays freezing in shorts and t-shirts, scattered in every direction. We should go! Daryl hollered in my ear, just barely audible over the shrieking of the sirens, which had been joined by traditional police sirens. A dozen SFPD cruisers screamed past us. Report to shelters immediately. Down to the BART station, I hollered. My friends nodded. We closed ranks and began to move quickly downhill. Chapter 3. We passed a lot of people in the road on the way to the Powell Street BART. They were running or walking, white-faced and silent, or shouting and panicked. Homeless people cowered in doorways and watched it all, while a tall black tranny hooker shouted at two mustached young men about something. The closer we got to the BART, the worse the press of bodies became. By the time we reached the stairway down into the station, it was a mob scene, a huge brawl of people trying to crowd their way down a narrow staircase. I had my face crushed up against someone's back, and someone else was pressed into my back. Daryl was still beside me. He was big enough that he was hard to shove, and Holu was right behind him, kind of hanging on to his waist. I spied Vanessa a few yards away, trapped by more people. "Screw you!" I heard Van yell behind me. "Pervert, get your hands off of me!" I strained around against the crowd and saw Van looking with disgust at an older guy in a nice suit who was kind of smirking at her.
She was digging in her purse, and I knew what she was digging for. "Don't mace him!" I shouted over the din. "You'll get us all, too!"
At the mention of the word mace, the guy looked scared and kind of melted back, though the crowd kept him moving forward. Up ahead, I saw someone, a middle-aged lady in a hippie dress, falter and fall. She screamed as she went down, and I saw her thrashing to get up, but she couldn't. The crowd's pressure was too strong. As I neared her, I bent to help her up and was nearly knocked over her. I ended up stepping on her stomach as the crowd pushed me past her, but by then, I don't think she was feeling anything. I was as scared as I'd ever been. There was screaming everywhere now, and more bodies on the floor, and the press from behind was as relentless as a bulldozer. It was all I could do to keep on my feet. We were in the open concourse where the turnstiles were. It was hardly any better here. The enclosed space sent the voices around us echoing back in a roar that made my head ring, and the smell and feeling of all those bodies made me feel a claustrophobia I'd never known I was prone to. People were still cramming down the stairs, and more were squeezing past the turnstiles and down the escalators onto the platforms, but it was clear to me that this wasn't going to have a happy ending. "Want to take our chances up top?" I said to Daryl. "Yes, hell yes," he said. "This is vicious." I looked to Vanessa. There was no way she'd hear me. I managed to get my phone out, and I texted her. "We're getting out of here." I saw her feel the vibe from her phone, then look down at it, and then back at me, and nod vigorously. Daryl, meanwhile, had clued Holu in.
"What's the plan?" Daryl shouted in my ear.
"We're going to have to go back," I shouted back, pointing at the remorseless crush of bodies.
"It's impossible," he said.
"It's just going to get more impossible the longer we wait." He shrugged. Van worked her way over to me and grabbed hold of my wrist. I took Daryl's, and Daryl took Holu by the other hand, and we pushed out. It wasn't easy. We moved about 3 inches a minute at first, then slowed down even more when we reached the stairway. The people we passed were none too happy about us shoving them out of the way either. A couple people swore at us, and there was a guy who looked like he'd have punched me if he'd been able to get his arms loose. We passed 3 more crushed people beneath us, but there was no way I could have helped them. By that point, I wasn't even thinking of helping anyone. All I could think of was finding the spaces in front of us to move into, of Daryl's mighty straining on my wrist, of my death grip on Van behind me. We popped free like champagne corks an eternity later, blinking in the gray, smoky light. The air raid sirens were still blaring, and the sound of emergency vehicle sirens as they tore down Market Street was even louder. There was almost no one on the streets anymore, just the people trying hopelessly to get underground. A lot of them were crying. I spotted a bunch of empty benches, usually staked out by skanky winos, and pointed toward them. We moved for them, the sirens and the smoke making us duck and hunch our shoulders. We got as far as the benches before Daryl fell forward. We all yelled, and Vanessa grabbed him and turned him over. The side of his shirt was stained red, and the stain was spreading. She tugged his shirt up and revealed a long, deep cut in his pudgy side.
"Someone freaking stabbed him in the crowd," Holu said, his hands clenching into fists. "Christ, that's vicious."
Daryl groaned and looked at us, then down at his side. Then he groaned, and his head went back again. Vanessa took off her jean jacket and then pulled off the cotton hoodie she was wearing underneath it. She wadded it up and pressed it to Daryl's side.
"Take his head," she said to me. "Keep it elevated."
To Holu, she said,
"Get his feet up. Roll your coat or something."
Holu moved quickly. Vanessa's mother is a nurse, and she'd had first aid training every summer at camp. She loved to watch people in movies get their first aid wrong and make fun of them. I was so glad to have her with us. We sat there for a long time, holding the hoodie to Daryl's side. He kept insisting that he was fine and that we should let him up.
and Van kept telling him to shut up and lie still before she kicked his ass.
What about calling 911? Holu said.
I felt like an idiot. I whipped my phone out and punched 911. The sound I got wasn't even a busy signal. It was like a whimper of pain from the phone system. You don't get sounds like that unless there's 3 million people all dialing the same number at once. Who needs botnets when you've got terrorists?
What about Wikipedia? Holu said.
No phone, no data, I said.
What about them?
Daryl said, and pointed at the street. I looked where he was pointing, thinking I'd see a cop or a paramedic, but there was no one there.
It's okay, buddy. You just rest, I said.
No, you idiot. What about them? The cops and the cars, there.
He was right. Every 5 seconds, a cop car, an ambulance, or a fire truck zoomed past. They could get us some help. I was such an idiot. Come on, then, I said. Let's get you where they can see you and flag one down. Vanessa didn't like it, but I figured a cop wasn't going to stop for a kid waving his hat in the street. Not that day. They just might stop if they saw Daryl bleeding there, though. I argued briefly with her, and Daryl settled it by lurching to his feet and dragging himself down toward Market Street. The first vehicle that screamed past, an ambulance, didn't even slow down. Neither did the cop car that went past, nor the fire truck, nor the next 3 cop cars. Daryl wasn't in good shape. He was white-faced and panting. Van's sweater was soaked in blood. I was sick of cars driving right past me. The next time a car appeared down Market Street, I stepped right out into the road, waving my arms over my head, shouting, "Stop!" The car slowed to a stop, and only then did I notice that it wasn't a cop car, ambulance, or fire engine. It was a military-looking Jeep, like an armored Hummer, only it didn't have any military insignia on it. The car skidded to a stop just in front of me, and I jumped back and lost my balance and ended up on the road. I felt the doors open near me, and then saw a confusion of booted feet moving close by. I looked up and saw a bunch of military-looking guys in coveralls, holding big, bulky rifles and wearing hooded gas masks with tinted faceplates. I barely had time to register them before those rifles were pointed at me. I'd never looked down the barrel of a gun before, but everything you've heard about the experience is true. You freeze where you are, time stops, and your heart thunders in your ears. I opened my mouth, then shut it, then, very slowly, I held my hands up in front of me. The faceless, eyeless, armed man above me kept his gun very level. I didn't even breathe. Van was screaming something, and Holu was shouting, and I looked at them for a second, and that was when someone put a coarse sack over my head and cinched it tight around my windpipe. So quick and so fiercely, I barely had time to gasp before it was locked on me. I was pushed roughly but dispassionately onto my stomach, and something went twice around my wrists, and then tightened up as well, feeling like baling wire and biting cruelly. I cried out, and my own voice was muffled by the hood. I was in total darkness now, and I strained my ears to hear what was going on with my friends. I heard them shouting through the muffling canvas of the bag, and then I was being impersonally hauled to my feet by my wrists, my arms wrenched up behind my back, my shoulders screaming. I stumbled some, then a hand pushed my head down, and I was inside the Hummer. More bodies were roughly shoved in beside me.
"Guys!"
I shouted, and earned a hard thump on my head for my trouble. I heard Holu respond, then felt the thump he was dealt too. My head rang like a gong.
"Hey," I said to the soldiers. "Hey, listen, we're just high school students. I wanted to flag you down because my friend was bleeding. Someone stabbed him."
I had no idea how much of this was making it through the muffling bag. I kept talking.
"Listen, this is some kind of misunderstanding. We've got to get my friend to a hospital."
Someone went upside my head again. It felt like they used a baton or something. It was harder than anyone had ever hit me in the head before. My eyes swam and watered, and I literally couldn't breathe through the pain. A moment later, I caught my breath, but I didn't say anything. I'd learned my lesson. Who were these clowns? They weren't wearing insignia. Maybe they were terrorists. I'd never really believed in terrorists before. I mean, I knew that in the abstract there were terrorists somewhere in the world, but they didn't really represent any risk to me. There were millions of ways that the world could kill me, starting with getting run down by a drunk burning his way down Valencia, that were infinitely more likely and immediate than terrorists. Terrorists killed a lot less people than bathroom falls and accidental electrocutions. Worrying about them always struck me as about as useful as worrying about getting hit by lightning. Sitting in the back of that Hummer, my head in a hood, my hands lashed behind my back, lurching back and forth while the bruises swelled up on my head, terrorism suddenly felt a lot riskier. The car rocked back and forth and tipped uphill. I gathered we were headed over Knob Hill, and from the angle, it seemed we were taking one of the steeper routes. I guessed Powell Street. Now we were descending just as steeply. If my mental map was right, we were heading down to Fisherman's Wharf. You could get on a boat there, get away. That fit with the terrorism hypothesis. Why the hell would terrorists kidnap a bunch of high school students? We rocked to a stop, still on a downslope. The engine died and then the doors swung open. Someone dragged me by my arms out onto the road, then shoved me, stumbling, down a paved road. A few seconds later, I tripped over a steel staircase, bashing my shins. The hands behind me gave me another shove. I went up the stairs cautiously, not able to use my hands. I got up the third step and reached for the fourth, but it wasn't there. I nearly fell again, but new hands grabbed me from in front and dragged me down a steel floor and then forced me to my knees and locked my hands to something behind me. More movement, and the sense of bodies being shackled in alongside of me. Groans and muffled sounds. Laughter. Then a long, timeless eternity in the muffled gloom, breathing my own breath, hearing my own breath in my ears. I actually managed a kind of sleep there, kneeling with the circulation cut off to my legs, my head in canvas twilight. My body had squirted a year's supply of adrenaline into my bloodstream in the space of 30 minutes. And while that stuff can give you the strength to lift cars off your loved ones and leap over tall buildings, the payback's always a bitch. I woke up to someone pulling the hood off my head. They were neither rough nor careful, just impersonal. Like someone at McDonald's putting together burgers. The light in the room was so bright I had to squeeze my eyes shut, but slowly I was able to open them to slits. Then cracks, then all the way, and look around. We were all in the back of a truck, a big 16-wheeler. I could see the wheel wells at regular intervals down the length, but the back of this truck had been turned into some kind of mobile command post jail. Steel desks lined the walls, with banks of slick flat panel displays climbing above them, on articulated arms that let them be repositioned in a halo around the operators. Each desk had a gorgeous office chair in front of it, festooned with user interface knobs for adjusting every millimeter of the sitting surface, as well as height, pitch, and yaw. Then there was the jail part. At the front of the truck, farthest away from the doors, there were steel rails bolted into the sides of the vehicle, and attached to these steel rails were the prisoners. I spotted Van and Holu right away. Daryl might have been in the remaining dozen shackled up back here, but it was impossible to say. Many of them were slumped over and blocking my view. It stank of sweat and fear back there. Vanessa looked at me and bit her lip. She was scared. So was I. So was Holu. his eyes rolling crazily in their sockets, the whites showing. I was scared. What's more, I had to piss like a racehorse. I looked around for our captors. I'd avoided looking at them up until now, the same way you don't look into the dark of a closet where your mind has conjured up a boogeyman. You don't want to know if you're right. But I had to get a better look at these jerks who'd kidnapped us. If they were terrorists, I wanted to know. I didn't know what a terrorist looked like, though TV shows had done their best to convince me that they were brown Arabs with big beards and knit caps and loose cotton dresses that hung down to their ankles. Not so our captors. They could have been halftime show cheerleaders on the Super Bowl. They looked American in a way I couldn't exactly define. Good jaw lines, short, neat haircuts that weren't quite military. They came in white and brown, male and female, and smiled freely at one another as they sat down at the other end of the truck, joking and drinking coffee out of go cups. These weren't Arabs from Afghanistan. They looked like tourists from Nebraska. I stared at one, a young white woman with brown hair who barely looked older than me, kind of cute in a scary office power suit way. If you stare at someone long enough, they'll eventually look back at you. She did, and her face slammed into a totally different configuration, dispassionate, even robotic. The smile vanished in an instant. "Hey," I said. "Look, I don't understand what's going on here, but I really need to take a leak, you know?" She looked right through me as if she hadn't heard. "I'm serious. If I don't get to a can soon, I'm going to have an ugly accident. It's going to get pretty smelly back here, you know?" She turned to her colleagues, a little huddle of three of them, and they held a low conversation I couldn't hear over the fans from the computers. She turned back to me. "Hold it for another 10 minutes, then you'll each get a piss call." "I don't think I've got another 10 minutes in me," I said, letting a little more urgency than I was really feeling creep into my voice. "Seriously, lady, it's now or never." She shook her head and looked at me like I was some kind of pathetic loser. She and her friends conferred some more, then another one came forward. He was older, in his early 30s, and pretty big across the shoulders, like he worked out. He looked like he was Chinese or Korean. Even Van can't tell the difference sometimes, but with that bearing that said American in a way I couldn't put my finger on. He pulled his sports coat aside to let me see the hardware strapped there. I recognized a pistol, a taser, and a can of either mace or pepper spray before he let it fall again.
"No trouble," he said.
"None," I agreed. He touched something at his belt, and the shackles behind me let go, my arms dropping suddenly behind me. It was like he was wearing Batman's utility belt. Wireless remotes for shackles. I guessed it made sense, though. You wouldn't want to lean over your prisoners with all that deadly hardware at their eye level. They might grab your gun with their teeth and pull the trigger with their tongues or something. My hands were still lashed together behind me by the plastic strapping, and now that I wasn't supported by the shackles, I found that my legs had turned into lumps of cork while I was stuck in one position. Long story short, I basically fell onto my face and kicked my legs weakly as they went pins and needles, trying to get them under me so I could rock up to my feet. The guy jerked me to my feet, and I clown-walked to the very back of the truck, to a little boxed-in porta-john there. I tried to spot Daryl on the way back, but he could have been any of the 5 or 6 slumped people, or none of them.
"In you go," the guy said.
I jerked my wrists. "Take these off, please." My fingers felt like purple sausages from the hours of bondage in the plastic cuffs. The guy didn't move. "Look," I said, trying not to sound sarcastic or angry. It wasn't easy. "Look, you either cut my wrists free or you're going to have to aim for me. A toilet visit is not a hands-free experience." Someone in the truck sniggered. The guy didn't like me. I could tell from the way his jaw muscles ground around. Man, these people were wired tight.
He reached down to his belt and came up with a very nice set of multi-pliers. He flicked out a wicked-looking knife and sliced through the plastic cuffs, and my hands were my own again.
Thanks, I said.
He shoved me into the bathroom. My hands were useless, like lumps of clay on the ends of my wrists. As I wiggled my fingers limply, they tingled. Then the tingling turned to a burning feeling that almost made me cry out. I put the seat down, dropped my pants, and sat down. I didn't trust myself to stay on my feet. As my bladder cut loose, so did my eyes. I wept, crying silently and rocking back and forth while the tears and snot ran down my face. It was all I could do to keep from sobbing. I covered my mouth and held the sounds in. I didn't want to give them the satisfaction. Finally, I was peed out and cried out, and the guy was pounding on the door. I cleaned my face as best as I could with wads of toilet paper, stuck it all down the john and flushed. Then looked around for a sink, but only found a pump bottle of heavy-duty hand sanitizer covered in small print lists of the bioagents it worked on. I rubbed some into my hands and stepped out of the john.
What were you doing in there? The guy said.
Using the facilities, I said.
He turned me around and grabbed my hands, and I felt a new pair of plastic cuffs go around them. My wrists had swollen since the last pair had come off, and the new ones bit cruelly into my tender skin, but I refused to give him the satisfaction of crying out. He shackled me back to my spot and grabbed the next person down, who, I saw now, was Holu, his face puffy and an ugly bruise on his cheek.
"Are you okay?"
I asked him, and my friend with the utility belt abruptly put his hand on my forehead and shoved hard, bouncing the back of my head off the truck's metal wall with a sound like a clock striking one.
"No talking," he said
as I struggled to refocus my eyes. I didn't like these people. I decided right then that they would pay a price for all this. One by one, all the prisoners went to the can and came back. And when they were done, my guard went back to his friends and had another cup of coffee. They were drinking out of a big cardboard urn of Starbucks, I saw, and they had an indistinct conversation that involved a fair bit of laughter. Then the door at the back of the truck opened, and there was fresh air. Not smoky the way it had been before, but tinged with ozone. In the slice of outdoors I saw before the door closed, I caught that it was dark out and raining, with one of those San Francisco drizzles that's part mist. The man who came in was wearing a military uniform, a U.S. military uniform. He saluted the people in the truck, and they saluted him back, and that's when I knew that I wasn't a prisoner of some terrorists. I was a prisoner of the United States of America.